I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Larry Krasner does not have the typical resume for district attorney, having spent most of his professional life as a civil rights and defense attorney and having sued the Philadelphia police force some 75 times. He campaigned on a progressive agenda promising to change the approach to criminal justice that has given the city one of the highest incarceration rates in the country. Larry Krasner has been on the job for about 6 months, and he has made some waves. Cleaning house in the department, advocating for safe injection sites, ending the cash bail program for low-level offenders, and yesterday telling undocumented immigrants that if they testify in court or press charges, they will not be turned over to federal officials. On Monday, he negotiated a deal involving the murder of Police Sergeant Robert Wilson III. He did not seek the death penalty for Carlton Hips and Ramon Williams, who pleaded guilty and gave up their right to appeal. They were sentenced to life plus 50 to 100 years. Some members of Wilson's family and the police department are angry about how this case was handled. Well, we asked Larry Krasner to join us on Radio Times. He was a guest when he was a candidate. Now he is the Philadelphia District Attorney. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Now, I know you campaigned in opposition to the death penalty. Explain your decision in this case involving the sergeant.
So the decision in this case was made on a, as they will all be made, on a very individual basis, meaning that there is a committee within the office that considers all the factors we should consider in deciding whether or not to recommend a death sentence. Their recommendation goes to me. I make the final decision. This was an example of a case in which we took a whole lot of time. We spent more than 2 hours in the home of the grandmother of Sergeant Wilson, and also Sergeant Wilson's sister was there, as well as about 25 other people, some family. We heard everything they had to say.
When was this?
This would have been in February. It was fairly shortly after we were in office. And we took every bit of that into account. But we also heard from the two mothers of the children of Sergeant Wilson, whose position was that they did not want the death penalty. And they did not want it for reasons that make a lot of sense to victims' advocates, which is that they did not want the children of Sergeant Wilson to have their identity forever forged as simply being, you know, the son of or the child of a slain police officer. They did not want the kids exposed to the publicity that would surround it. They, most of all, they did not want the kids exposed to the video of Sergeant Wilson's killing, which is searing and difficult to watch and very hard to forget, and frankly traumatic, and probably far more traumatic to those kids than it would be to anyone else. So, you know, they understood. They understood that if there was a trial verdict, and especially if there was a death penalty, that there would be hearings going on for 25 or 35 years, and every time a new hearing came up, that those kids would be notified in their adulthood, long after these mothers had passed, long after the grandmother and the sister were gone. These kids are the ones who would have to bear the burden of that, the re-traumatization, experiencing it all over again. That is not what they wanted. And so when it became clear that a sentence of life without any possibility of parole, plus 50 to 100 years consecutive time was...
Meaning they'll never get out of prison.
Under Pennsylvania law, they will never get out of prison. They will die the same way someone on death row dies in Pennsylvania, and that is of natural causes, because the reality is there's been no execution in Pennsylvania that was involuntary since 1962.
Let me play. This is the sister of the murdered police officer, Sergeant Robert Wilson III. This is Shakira Wilson Burroughs speaking to NBC 10 on June 22nd, just earlier this week.
Almost speechless, angry. When I got the call, I was shaking because it literally makes no sense at all. It just feels like it was too many secrets, even just going through, even, you know, once this administration came into office. Everything's hush-hush, even with the prosecutor's office. It feels as though the district attorney's hand is covering their mouths. They don't talk to us either. Like, it's a disgrace.
They didn't discuss this with you?
Not at all.
She says this was never discussed with the family. Her complaint there was that the family was notified about this plea deal on Friday afternoon around 4 o'clock. And then, of course, the deal became official on Monday, feeling as if they were not included in this decision. Curious about your response.
You know, when I hear any victim or survivor talking about situation of a killing, I have to always start with the assumption that we're dealing with someone who has been traumatized and is grieving. But when Ms. Wilson-Burrow says they were not consulted at all, I mean, that's flatly untrue. We spent more time with them than I think I have spent with any victim's family since we have been in office.
More than that one meeting that you mentioned earlier in the winter?
We had the one meeting, which frankly is something that Lynn Abraham never did. Other DAs never go to the home of victims, sit down next to them, listen for 2 hours. And frankly, you know, they were very strong in their opinions. They shared those opinions with us.
Were you there?
I was there. Okay. I was sitting right next to the grandmother the whole time. You know, there were times when they were so emotional that they were yelling, that they were screaming, that they were yelling over each other. And I get that. I understand that. But to say that they were not consulted at all is simply untrue. Part of the challenge we had here is that there has been harassment of the mothers. I repeat, there has been harassment of the mothers in civil court, in physical aggression, verbal aggression toward them because of the position that they are taking. And in order to protect the mothers, we could not expose them to a long period of hostility after coming to a determination. The truth is that the final decision on the part of these defendants to take this plea had to be accomplished by their lawyers over the weekend, because that is how it had come together. And we knew it would be better for everyone, including the family, if this all went down at a status listing rather than waiting for months and going up to the date of trial. We also knew it was much better for protecting the mothers from the hostility they were suffering to have it go quickly. So it went down the way it had to go down, but partly it had to go down that way because of what I consider, frankly, to be unacceptable efforts at what is arguably intimidation.
Well, in fact, you're quoted as saying that your office may have to take legal action against the people responsible for, as you say, harassing or even threatening the mothers of the children of the sergeant.
You know, I would like to think.
Are we talking about police officers? Are we talking about
one of the mothers identified the FOP as a source of specific harassment that occurred over the weekend before this plea went down? I would like to think that a top priority for any legitimate police union leadership would be the protection of the children of a slain officer, or the protection of the mothers of the children of a slain officer. But unfortunately, it is pretty clear that the leadership of the FOP in Philadelphia viewed this case more as a political opportunity and was far less concerned with caring for the children of a slain officer and the mothers of those children than they were with dealing, than they were with their politics.
Have you talked to the police commissioner about this?
Yes.
What's that conversation been?
I called him over the weekend and left a message requesting that he intervene so that the weekend would not develop the way it was developing. It is my understanding, not directly from him because we have not had a chance to speak, mm-hmm. but from other sources, that he did intervene, that he made some calls because he, too, found this kind of conduct unacceptable.
I know Seth Williams, your predecessor, said in this case that he would seek the death penalty for Hips and Williams, and he saw this as a capital punishment case. Is this a kind of a test case for you as an opponent of the death penalty?
I'm not sure how to answer that, and I'm not trying to be cheeky, but I was elected, frankly, in a landslide. There was a quantity of votes that turned out that was higher than any DA's election in the last 20 years. And it wasn't because of me personally. It was because of a group of ideas and a movement behind those ideas. One of those ideas was that the death penalty is just not a great idea. Okay? Now,
a great idea because?
For 100 reasons. But, you know, among them that it's never actually applied in Pennsylvania. Among them that it's cost $1 billion in the last 50 years. And yet it's never applied. Among them that it re-traumatizes families on an ongoing basis after it occurs for 25, 35 years. I mean, it's so bad that if you actually look at decisions that have been made, for example, by the ex-wife of a slain officer in another case, you'll find out that 25 years after there was a death penalty imposed, when that death penalty was overturned and the DA's office had the chance to pursue it yet again, her response was, don't. Enough. Closure, please. So there are many, many, many reasons. But, you know, obviously, as with most of the policies of my office, the most vital reason is that we have to put resources into things that work. Death penalty did not stop the killing of Officer Wilson. It has not stopped the killing of any officer. It is nothing but a drum to beat that accomplishes nothing. And if we were putting that money into things that actually prevent crime, we have a better chance of stopping the next one.
I should say to our listeners that the last time the death penalty was carried out was Gary Heidnik, who actually wanted to be executed. That was in 1999. And I guess the last time it was carried out, probably against the will of the person who was on death row, was 1962.
Correct.
So it's been more than 50 years since there has been a death penalty in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Just curious about whether, in hindsight, you would have handled this any differently.
No.
No?
No. I mean, honestly, there is the narrative around it, and there's the truth. And the truth is that if I have to make a decision about doing what is politically expedient as opposed to doing what is right, I'm going to do what I honestly believe is right. I understand I will make mistakes from time to time. I make no claims to perfection. I make no claims to be a role model. But we did what we thought was right, and we did what was absolutely necessary to protect these two mothers and their two children.
There's a quote, actually, Annette John Hall had a piece in WHYY's news site, quoting Jennifer Storm of the Pennsylvania Office of Victim Advocate. This is actually about a report that just came out yesterday on capital punishment in Pennsylvania. The quote is, "The overwhelming majority of victims we serve who have offenders on death row and are in favor of it want to see it carried out. When you think about death penalty cases and why they're sought, you're talking about these horrific cases. These are people who have experienced egregious losses." What do you say, though, to someone who, like that, has a family member who has whose killer, frankly, is on death row, and they want it carried out?
You know, what I say is that people handle their grief in different ways, and certainly it's legitimate to think that the death penalty is great or that it's bad. Lynn Abraham used to talk about how, quote, passionate, unquote, she was about the death penalty. So those are legitimate viewpoints, and I respect their viewpoints.
How many people on death row in Pennsylvania now, do you know?
I believe it's about 149, 150.
And how does that compare to the rest of the country? Do you know that?
I know. I don't actually know for sure. I know that Pennsylvania has more people doing life without parole than any state other than Florida. I know that historically Pennsylvania has had a large death row and that it is shrinking. And it's shrinking because juries don't like the death penalty. They're not giving it anymore. And so people on death row are dying for the most part of natural causes.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Larry Krasner is our guest. He's the district attorney of Philadelphia, has been on the job since January, doing a lot of things in this city and getting a national reputation for himself as well. Just talked about a deal that his office negotiated involving the murder of Police Sergeant Robert Wilson III. The two men pled guilty for murdering him, gave up their right to appeal, sentenced to life plus 50 to 100 years. Other things to talk about as well. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Larry Krasner, Philadelphia's new district attorney. Let me read. I do want to move on from this, but I do want to read an email from Claire from Mount Airy. He says, "The best advice I ever got was don't just give your boss what they ask for. Give them what they need." How do you handle the experienced ADAs that work for you when they disagree with you about an approach in service to the victims of crimes?
You know, one of our greatest assets is some of the experienced district attorneys we have there. Of course, the challenge is that the younger attorneys are a lot more informed in kind of a modern way and not as entrenched in doing things a certain way. But, I mean, what I really like to see and I really appreciate is when we have DAs at all levels, but it's usually senior levels, who come to talk to me and tell me I don't like this policy and let me explain to you why. And we have frequently gotten details from that that we incorporated into our policies, even where we didn't reverse the policy. And those details, frankly, have been very important. So we appreciate that. But obviously the challenge, if you are someone who's defended free speech and free thought for your whole career, which I have, the challenge is you still need there to be discipline. You still need your senior DAs to go to court and to follow the policies of the office. They can't go into court and say the policy is, but I ain't following it just because I feel that way. They weren't elected. Those decisions are not there. So there is a real distinction between discipline in the courtroom and following the policies as they are, and then having this space for free thought in the office itself.
So when it comes to the courtroom, they are essentially following the mission, the policies that you have laid out.
Like any sports team, coach calls the plays and the players run them. If you're supposed to run a certain pattern and you decide you're going for the opposite goalpost, you're either on the bench or you're off the team. I mean, we all understand that in any other context, and this is no different.
You said yesterday that your office would not hand over to the federal government undocumented immigrants who go to court either to testify or to in some way make public some of their concerns or involvement in a crime of some sort. What kind of protection can you offer to someone who is undocumented in this country, in this city rather, especially if ICE, if the feds, they want to get them? And a court is a very public place.
Right. We cannot protect them against what ICE does on its own. But we can make sure that our lane is clear and that everything in our lane does not assist with that. You know, the federal government has been trying for a while to strong-arm cities into essentially becoming their uncompensated enforcers. We're not going to do that. I mean, for example, in August, there is a vote coming as to whether or not Philadelphia should share PARS information, which is...
What is that?
It's essentially police discovery information that has the potential to reveal details about immigrants and make it easier for ICE to come in, grab them, and deport them, and so on. Three votes exist on that, and I have one of those votes, and the vote's going to be no. What's the bad consequence? The bad consequence to the city may be the loss of about $1.5 million in dollars. But the good consequence to the city, and I sincerely hope that we will have support from the mayor, and I sincerely hope we'll have support from the courts, because those are the other two votes. The consequence for the city is that it will protect women who need to report that they are being abused, that they have been violated sexually, that their kids are being subjected to violence, and it will protect all types of immigrants who are the victims of crime. For 2 years now, we have had underreporting by immigrant communities of crimes committed against them because they have been made into targets, and they have been made into targets by Donald Trump. And that's the reality. This policy is causing crime. And if we are going to make a space where it's possible for that undocumented witness to come in and testify in favor of a U.S. citizen who is a victim or in favor of another undocumented person who is a victim, we're going to have to provide protection at least within our own lane, and that's what I intend to do.
This is a sanctuary city. Is it legal protection, or is it – can you physically prevent ICE from taking someone who went to court to testify?
No, we cannot prevent that. What we can do – though, is we can have a policy in the office that our ADAs are not to report, witnesses or defendants or victims to ICE, because we need to create that level of participation by undocumented people, and we do have that policy. We can vote against PARS, which we are doing, and we can also, in the appropriate case, we can seek U visas and seek other types of immigration remedies that have the potential to protect victims or protect those who cooperate with law enforcement. So within our lane, we can do everything we can. Now, that's more meaningful than it may seem, because no matter how voracious the Trump administration is, they just don't have that many boots on the ground.
Yeah. And since literally people.
If you look at what law enforcement really means in the United States, over 90% of it is at the state level. So if at the state level we're not doing their bidding, then they have far fewer boots. They can only move so quickly with their plans.
Philadelphia has, I want to get this right, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, if not the highest, among the highest incarceration rates of any large jurisdiction. Correct me if I'm wrong there.
It has, until recently at least, had the highest level of incarceration of any of the 10 largest cities.
Right.
Also the poorest of the 10 largest cities.
Is there a connection there?
Without question, there's a connection there. It is the poverty that feeds it, and it feeds the poverty. There is a direct connection there. It is getting better. I mean, at its peak, the Philadelphia County jails were up around 10,000. When Rich Negrin was at the MDO, we were at about 8,000. And as of today, we should be slightly over 5,000. And by that, I mean less than 5,100 people
in
county custody. We have an empty jail right now. I know we're all talking about not closing it for 2 years, but the fact is it's empty. So that is progress. And certainly there is more progress to be had, but that is significant progress.
Where do those people go? Is this the cash bail business?
It is a combination of a lot of things. There's a heck of a lot of good work that was done before this administration was in, and that was done by the MacArthur Foundation. It was done by the mayor. It was done by the city, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. But there has also been an increase in the decline of the population as a direct consequence of two policies that we have. One is our cash bail policy, and the other one is our policy around sentencing for non-serious offenses, where we've instructed our prosecutors to give offers that are below the bottom end of the Pennsylvania sentencing guidelines because those guidelines have pushed us to this point of mass incarceration.
How does a judge deal with that, though? Aren't they required to abide by those guidelines?
No. They are not required to abide by them.
The prosecution decides?
They are required to look at them. But these are not guidelines they must follow. They're simply guidelines. I mean, if you look at the word itself, guideline, it's simply a guideline. Look at this. You can follow this. This is what the thought of some statewide body was. Well, that statewide body, just so we're all clear, was not studying criminology, and they were not studying mass incarceration. They were engaging in what was a math exercise of trying to make sure that somehow we averaged out sentences being given in Greene County or Carbon County with sentences being given in Philadelphia County. The culture and the experience and the reality of Philadelphia has next to nothing to do with Carbon County. And to the extent we are averaging in Philadelphia in the direction of Carbon County, where they have a financial interest in prisons, and or in other counties where they have a financial interest in prisons. And
because they have prisons?
Because they have prisons, and they don't have coal. And, look right now at the state legislature in Pennsylvania, where you're seeing all this agitation and commotion about the closing of prisons. So there are people trying to introduce bills so you can't close a prison for at least a year. There has to be a study done. We have a monster here. There is a monster machine that now has all these employees, and it runs on money. And when they start to see that in Philadelphia or in other parts of the country, the number of prisoners is dropping, and they sense some sort of economic disadvantage, they're coming back at it, not for good reasons. You know, this money can go other places. Those employees can go other places and do work that actually stops crime. But it's like anything else, the status quo protects itself.
Let me reintroduce you. This is Larry Krasner. He is Philadelphia's district attorney, relatively new. He's been on the job for about 6 months and has gotten a lot of national attention, I should say, for his very progressive positions and approach to law enforcement. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me take a call. I'm not sure if it's line number one or line number two. Looks like we're going to line number two. Andrew from Pineville. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, hello. I just want to say how impressed I am with the first 6 months. I admire leaders that do what they promise, and I'm very excited, whether I agree or not with everything, I'm very excited to have somebody like that. And my question is, I've had to deal with the addiction problem in Philadelphia, opening in Fishtown soon, and I was wondering how you're making out with the addiction problem with regard to how it's clogging up the court system and costing so much money to Philadelphia.
Andrew, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. That gets us to safe injection sites, the opioid crisis, the war on drugs. Go ahead, Larry Krasner.
Sure. Thank you, Andrew. Although you're giving me a little too much credit, this really is a movement and always has been.
A grassroots movement.
Right? It has been a grassroots movement. And you know, it's interesting we're talking today. If we look at what happened with Ocasio-Cortez, for example,
in New York,
not so far away, what an exciting moment. And she talks about a movement as well, because that's exactly what it is in her case. But the answer to your question here is we are already making some moves. For example, we are not prosecuting marijuana possession at all. There were still 600 to 1,000 cases that were hanging around even after the mayor moved towards a civil citation format. We have a drug court. That drug court, unfortunately, has its spots filled about 70% with marijuana cases no longer. Marijuana shouldn't be in there at all. Frankly, it is not physiologically addictive. It doesn't belong there. So those folks are going to be moved out and addressed in other ways, and we are going to make sure that those beds are available, or those seats, I should say, are available for people who have much more serious problems, such as opioids. In terms of the supervised injection sites and harm reduction, our position remains the same, and we believe that there will probably be, much as there was with Needle Exchange, an organic grassroots movement that's going to come forward, and they're going to try to create these centers which save lives and get people into addiction treatment. And this DA's office will not prosecute that. We will not prosecute it because there's no good legal basis for prosecuting it, because this falls within the law of justification in Pennsylvania. It's the defense of others. It's like, very much like self-defense. But we're also not going to prosecute it because we have the discretion not to prosecute it. We need to save lives, not end them. And we have four people dying every day in Philadelphia from fatal overdoses, mostly from opioids.
How does that compare to other big cities near the top?
As of the most recent data I saw, the worst county in the United States was Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, also known as Pittsburgh, and the second worst was Philadelphia County, Pennsylvania.
Wow. There have been, I mean, I completely agree in this approach of treating addiction as opposed to incarcerating addiction. But there has been some criticism when you look at how this country dealt with crack cocaine, throwing a lot of people in prison, versus how it is dealing with opioids. And maybe we have learned some things in the last couple of years, but some seeing kind of a racial component to that as well. What do you see?
They're right. I mean, when it came to locking up black people, history speaks for itself. We did that, and we made crack, 100 times worse in our federal sentencing guidelines than cocaine, even though it's the same substance. And when you cook down cocaine to make crack, the volume reduces only, 40% or so. It's not this absurd relation. There's no question that there is a very strongly racial component to how drug enforcement was done in the past. The decision we face now is, do we want to keep doing stupid? Or do we want to admit that that was a mistake? And do we want to ratchet in the direction of sensible equality as opposed to discriminatory equality? I mean, we have to try to do things that are better. That is a shameful piece of our history. But what we need to do is view this as what it really is, a medical condition, and go from there.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The problem, I think, with that is we do not have enough beds for all the people that need treatment, and treatment is complicated. People screw up and they go back to addicting, and then the cycle repeats over and over again. How do you replace, without opening mental institutions, how do you replace prison with some kind of treatment facility or facilities?
You get the money out of prisons.
You take that money from prisons.
You get the money out of things that don't work, like prisons, and you put it into things that do work. The reality is that addiction is not simply confined to illegal substances. We have a lot more people dying from alcohol than we do from opioids, despite the fact that this is a desperate and awful crisis we're in. We have more people dying from tobacco. Everybody understands that when someone is an alcoholic or someone is suffering from an addiction to tobacco, it may take them many, many, many tries to get off of it, and sometimes they never do. That's just the reality. We accept that as being sort of medically what occurs. Well, the same thing occurs with drugs. And so, I've known people who were addicted to heroin for 12 years, got off, 8 years later relapsed, got off, and they're doing well now. You have to give people the opportunity to recover. If it means they go into treatment several times, so be it. But as long as we are tying up all of our assets and being the most incarcerated country in the world, we're not going to have assets for public health, and this is a public health issue.
The city has sued the opioid manufacturers, in a sense, for creating this crisis. What do you hope to get out of that suit?
City has sued, and separate and apart from that, the district attorney's office has sued because the DA's office has a slightly different enforcement power under consumer protection law. What do we hope to get out of it? We hope to get a lot of the profit that was, frankly, stolen from residents of Philadelphia and was funneled into the accounts of people who are in the pharmaceutical industry. We hope to get that back to deal with a lot of the crises that were caused by the false advertising around what has become corporate drug dealing. Mm. We also hope to create financial pressure so that the supply of pills will be shrunk back to its level of over 10 years ago, which means a 3- or 4-fold reduction in the supply of pills, because new folks who are addicted are being created every day simply by this bizarre excessive supply of pills.
I've seen doctors saying that now there's a shortage and they feel like they can't do their job because all of a sudden pain medication, opioids are seen as, as the devil.
Well, they're they are the devil in some ways. I mean, let's get real. For those of us who've been on the planet a while, and I'm 57, the world didn't end in 1979 when they weren't pumping out this many opioid medications. Everything was going along okay. And when you look at the reality of this, which is that people who get a prescription of 10 days or more, according to the CDC, are becoming addicted at a rate of 20%. This is a machine. Mm-hmm. We are manufacturing people to have addictions. And those people were often athletes. They were often physical laborers who just simply became injured. And some doctor told them it's okay to take this stuff. It's really not okay, except in the most extreme situations of pain, except in situations involving terminal patients. It's really not okay to be giving out these pills like they're candy.
Did you think when you were running for DA that you would be this involved in dealing with the opioid crisis?
Yes. It's, I mean, Philadelphia is one of the epicenters, mm-hmm. unfortunately. And having had a long history of dealing with the HIV/AIDS crisis from the perspective of supporting people who did Prevention Point and supporting people mm-hmm. who were involved in the protest to get big pharma manufacturers to do the kind of things they eventually were forced to do, I saw this as, frankly, a repeat of that, that there was going to be a grassroots fight against Big Pharma, and that I would be in a position, if I was lucky enough to be elected with this movement, to be able to assist.
Mm. Have you been up to Kensington, to the encampment, seen what that looks like?
I have been there driving around in cars. You know, I have been there in many different contexts. And it is what it is, you know. It's something that we have to address at many different levels. Some of them involve traditional law enforcement doing something they're not as accustomed to doing, which is going after pharmacies and going after medical professionals and going after corporations. But also there's the more traditional law enforcement aspect to it, that we can't have, you know, open-air markets of heroin. It is not okay.
That is Larry Krasner, our guest on Radio Times today. He's the District Attorney of Philadelphia. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation and talk to you as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and if you're just joining us, Philadelphia's District Attorney Larry Krasner is our guest. He's been busy in his 6 months or so on the job. He cleaned house. He's instituted a number of broad reforms, including safe injection sites. He told undocumented immigrants yesterday that he will try to protect them if they do testify in court. We've also been talking about a decision earlier this week not to seek the death penalty in a plea deal for two men in the murder of a police officer. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Jen from Philadelphia. This takes us back to where we were talking about in the beginning of the show, but Jen, I wanted to get you on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I was a DA in Philadelphia for 10 years, fortunately not under Mr. Krasner. And I'm calling to find out why Anthony Bochy, the head of the homicide unit, walked out of court before the victim impact statements in the Wilson trial were given, when it's customary for the DA handling the case and the chief of homicide to sit there and listen to the victim impact statements because they represent the victims of crime and not the defendants.
Jen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times again, talking about this this case involving the murder of Police Sergeant Robert Wilson III.
She's not correct.
He did not walk out?
That's not true.
He stayed there?
He was there throughout the hearing.
Were you there throughout the hearing?
I was there for about the first hour and a half of the hearing.
Were you there for victim impact statements?
I was there. I was there for discussion of the presentation under seal. A victim impact statement on behalf of the mothers because of the pressure that they were under. I left the courtroom because we were receiving a phone call or a text from one of the mothers about the situation. We had some questions about how she wanted us to present it. And I then, frankly, was dealing on and off for a couple of hours with police and others with these issues around intimidation. So that was my participation.
Jen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. A tweet from Victoria: I was a strong supporter of Krasner due to my opposition to the death penalty and mass incarceration of the poor and people of color. As a victim of violent crime, I just want justice for victims, but focus on violent crime, not nonviolent crime. And I know that's part of what you have been doing in Philadelphia, which is focusing largely on the more violent crime and taking a more hands-off approach, I guess we could say, or a different kind of approach to lesser crimes. Can you explain that?
Well, you know, the whole system is operated kind of like a chainsaw. There has been an excited willingness to stick people in jail for stuff we never stuck them in jail for the longest time. And it has many detriments, but just one of those detriments is it makes it much harder to focus on the crimes that are serious. We know that 6% of criminals commit about 60% of the serious crime, and we have to go after them. But if we're spending all of our time over-incarcerating, over-charging, over-supervising people who don't require that level, then it's much harder for us mm-hmm. to actually be good at getting at the people we need to pursue.
What do you do about that 6%? I remember doing a show about that a couple of years ago, this realization that it was a small group of people involved with most of the crimes mm-hmm. in Philadelphia, and there was a task force set up to try to address it. I mean, that seems like something that could be quite manageable when you're talking about a small percentage of people.
It is something that certainly can be a lot more manageable. I mean, we have done some sort of traditional law enforcement things in terms of readjusting how we deal with the gun violence task force in which we are a part. You know, and I don't want to do what DAs have done time immemorial, which is take credit and act like I somehow have control over the crime rate. But here's the truth. The truth is, even though there have been a whole lot of people who have gotten out of jail and the sentences are getting much shorter under this administration, if you actually look at violent crime in the first 6 months of this year, what you'll find is that homicide is down anywhere from 6% to 20%, that all violent crimes are down, rape is down, gunpoint robbery is down. The only one that's up, as of the last time I checked, which was a couple days ago, is shootings are up about 2%. But in every other violent crime category, it's coming down. So what we certainly can say, which is true, is that these policies have not caused a crime spike. And there is good reason to think that the ways that we are trying to go, which is to focus on the serious stuff and stop wasting our time prosecuting marijuana possession, is certainly not making things worse and arguably is making it better.
A comment from Pete: where does the DA stand on the movement to abolish ICE? And some people have called for abolishing ICE, which was created after September 11th.
The DA fortunately doesn't have to stand on that because I am, you know, an elected official by the citizens of Philadelphia, the voters of Philadelphia anyway, and I work under state law. So the DA of the Philadelphia has no specific response at this time.
Playing it safe?
That's right.
Let's talk about juvenile lifers. Philadelphia apparently sentenced more teenagers to life than any other jurisdiction. Again, correct me if I'm right or wrong about that.
Well, we know this. We know that Pennsylvania had more juvenile lifers at the time the Supreme Court said that juvenile life was unconstitutional.
Which was a couple of years ago.
Right. Than any other state and than any other country in the world. And we also know that Philadelphia is the largest jurisdiction and it generates the largest portion of the state prison population. So that sounds right.
So since the Supreme Court made that decision, what has your office done, or I guess I should say in the last 6 months, on this issue?
Well, we are charged with conducting the resentencings. And by that, I mean judges make the determinations, but it's my office's job to make recommendations. And that is that is true for probably more than half of the total of these folks. A fair number of them were resentenced under the prior administration, but we're looking at probably 180 resentencings that will occur under this administration. We have a committee that very carefully considers each case. And what that means, of course, is you look not only at the crime, but consistent with the Supreme Court's ruling, you look heavily at conduct since the crime mm-hmm. and also the circumstances that came before the crime itself that describe the life of the defendant. You also speak to the victims, and we have spent a lot of time talking to the families of victims when they are still available. Understand, some of these defendants have been in jail 40 years. Mm-hmm. And when you go to try to find families of the victim, they're not necessarily to be found, right? Despite best efforts and some good efforts. So you take all of that into account, and then we come to a recommendation. In general, our recommendations are lower than the prior administration. And in general, our recommendations are either being followed exactly or are being accepted in I'd say, the vast, vast majority of cases. Every now and then, the judges disagree, as mm-hmm. frankly they should. Otherwise, they wouldn't be earning their paychecks. But for the most part, you know, what we are seeing, I think, systemically is lower recommended sentences, lower sentences coming through. However, they're extremely individual. You know, we have recommended 38 years in one case, and we have recommended 17 years in another case, because that is what the facts and the law required.
I have a piece of the slang of Gerard Grenzel. He lived on Spring Garden, in the Spring Garden area neighborhood, was shot by a 16-year-old, and your department, your office, wants to try him as an adult. Can you speak to that at all?
I can speak in very limited ways. That case is still pending, and for ethical reasons and also just because it's the right thing to do. We don't want to politicize these cases. We don't want to influence jurors one way or another. We want it to be a fair process. But that is a tragic, horrifying case in which the jurisdiction over the case began in adult court, because under Pennsylvania law, all homicides begin in adult court. So the only issue that was raised as to whether it would be heard in adult court or juvenile court was a, frankly, boilerplate motion that was filed by the defense saying send this back to juvenile court with no real support for it. And ultimately, when we did our own investigation and inquiry, we did not see significant support for the matter being handled in juvenile court under all the circumstances. So we expect it to remain and be adjudicated in adult court.
So there are, I'm just underscoring what you're saying, there are going to be individual cases where a juvenile under your department would be tried as an adult.
Yes.
Let me read an email from Roxanne. I'm a strong supporter, but why? Why are you pursuing misdemeanor charges that would carry a 7-year sentence for Regina Seguin, a trans woman arrested at Pride and then put in a men's prison? You're talking about focusing on violent crime. She didn't hurt anyone. Can you speak to that?
Sure. So let us understand that this is a case in which the police department initially recommended a variety of felony charges against this defendant, which were dropped by my office. Currently, there are pending misdemeanor charges, and the matter is still under investigation because it is a pending case. We have not come up on an important court date yet, and there may very well be additional decisions made about this case. But as of now, it's under consideration. That's all I can say.
And that is Larry Krasner. Again, he's the district attorney of Philadelphia. He's been on the job since January. He's gotten a fair amount of attention both locally but also nationally, considered to be one of the most progressive DAs in the country. And we are talking to him on Radio Times, picking his brain about a whole host of really important issues. And we want you to join us. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This week, Governor Wolf of Pennsylvania signed the clear, I can't read my own handwriting, a bill that if someone is arrested or convicted on a summary offense or a misdemeanor and they do not break the law again, they will have their criminal records sealed. Are you in support of this?
Yes.
Clean slate bill. There you go.
Thank
you.
Clean slate, right. I'm in support of this. There is sort of a very basic level, which is that rather than debilitate young people from being able to get a job and make a living, clean slate is aimed at making it possible for them to get the job on their own merits. Mm-hmm. And also, frankly, allowing us to eliminate things from records that really shouldn't reflect on someone for the rest of their life. But there's a more profound aspect to this, and we're going to see more clean slate type legislation and broader legislation, which is that to some extent, criminal records really are an inventory of racist and improper criminal justice practices historically. I mean, what does it mean in California when you have legalized marijuana to have a whole group of people who have convictions on their record for possession of marijuana? What does that mean? What are you doing other than keeping a history of discriminatory enforcement? Because we all know that there's just as much mm-hmm. weed use, among affluent whites as there are among working class and poor blacks. But the poor blacks are going to have the records because of levels of enforcement. So this is a very, very important issue. We have to look at, whether we consider a criminal act, especially one that's minor, to be a permanent lifelong status, or we consider it to be a bill that you can pay.
So as the laws change, those prior arrests should be expunged?
A lot of them, yeah.
Because what we evolve, we change.
People do evolve, and they do change. And you know, that's not just my opinion. I mean, if you look, for example, at the juvenile lifers who have been released in Pennsylvania, or you look, for example, at the three strikes life sentence serving folks in California who have been freed, and they were freed because California couldn't afford to keep putting its entire population in jail. You look at what they actually did after they got out. Recidivism is quite low among these groups. I mean, that's just a fact. It's not an opinion. It's reality. That's not to say that none of them are going to commit crimes. I mean, if I walk down the street right now, I will see a bunch of strangers, and some of them are going to commit crimes, but not because they have a scarlet letter on their forehead, just because that's human nature. So, yeah, people can change. Obviously, this is a very, very individual determination, but people can change. A lot of them do change, and we find that most people age out of criminal conduct.
So once they're, what, 35, 40 years old? Chances are they're not going to recommit?
The data supports that. Obviously, it's even they're even less likely to commit crimes when they're old heads like me and they've hit 57. But the data supports that there's a decline in criminal activity, that they desist from criminal activity, sometimes because of good developments in their life. And we want those good developments to happen, like jobs, you know, like marriage or at least long-term relationships. Sometimes it's military service. There are all sorts of different things that are correlated with people desisting from the commission of crime, but age is probably the greatest.
That's Larry Krasner, and I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. How would you describe your relationship with the police department?
I think my relationship with the commissioner and with the brass is excellent. You know, I have him on speed dial. He has me on speed dial. When we're going to do something like no longer prosecute marijuana possession, I call him in advance so that he can make any adjustments in how he uses his resources in the department. When we made a determination in the Wilson case, I called the commissioner, spoke to him personally about it so he would be aware of what was coming. And when I felt that there was a real serious issue of intimidation against the mothers and the children of a slain officer because of their position on how they felt on the death penalty, I called him again because I knew that that he wants the right thing to be done. I knew he would try to do the right thing. And I think the commissioner also is aware that just as he wants his officers to be accountable and to operate under normal discipline, that's what I want. So we have the potential, I think, to be very supportive of each other, even when we disagree. And he did not, you know, he came out and said that he would have preferred the death penalty in that case. I respect that. The FOP is another story. I mean, the reality is that the leadership of the FOP is white dominated. It is, you know, it is a group that endorsed Donald Trump, who has made it very clear that he doesn't like women and he doesn't like children and he doesn't like black people. And that is one of the reasons that we saw the African-American Police Officers Association in Philly come out angrily talking about the endorsement of Trump and come out and endorse me when I ran. You know, the current leadership of the FOP, I think, is a real detriment to the rank and file officers. And it is my hope that the overwhelming number of them who are honest and hardworking and talented, who are not racist, who do not hate women, who do not hate children, who are not political, it's my hope that they'll drive them out and that the leadership of the police union will change to people who have adjusted their clocks past 1954.
Have you ever talked to the head of the FOP?
Many times.
What's that like?
Well, first of all, I've known him 20 years. And the way I first met him was when he was being deposed as a witness in relation to police corruption trials, okay? So he and I go back a ways, but I've spoken to him since I've been in office, before I was in office. We talked specifically, for example, about the list of officers who have had certain troubles in their careers. And I look forward to his input. I just don't look forward to intimidation, abuse, and mistreatment of the mothers of the children of slain officers.
We're going to stop on that note. Larry Krasner, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Great. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And he is the District Attorney of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and check out some of the photos we took with Larry Krasner. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us.